Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk about what worked for me, but also those big epic fails I've made along the way. And I interview people who know a whole lot more about this stuff than I do. And that's what today's episode is all about. And so today's episode, we interview someone named Kieran Omani. And I really enjoyed this episode. I actually had a great conversation with him ahead of time. I love how thoughtful he is. I love how counterintuitive some of his ideas are, how science-based and brain-based all of it is, his knowledge of neuroscience. This really was an episode where we explore some ideas that I don't know a lot about. And so it was really cool for me to get to ask questions and take a deeper dive into it. A little bit about him. So Kieran Omani is the founding principal of the Institute for Connecting Neuroscience with Teaching and Learning. He's the chief learning officer at Hue Learn, H-U-E, Learn, and emeritus research scientist at Neural Education. And he's done a lot. He's an internationally recognized education expert and speaker, coach, author. He's published hundreds of academic papers, books, chapters, all kinds of different things. He's an acclaimed scholar in the learning sciences, geographical sciences, and higher education, but he's also incredibly down to earth. And I found that he reminded me in this interview of the importance of not only knowing the research, but connecting it to our practice in a very real and human way. So I hope you enjoy this podcast interview as much as I enjoyed getting a chance to do it. All right, we have with us here Kieran Omani, and I am really excited. He's going to be talking about what does a brain-based learning approach, classroom approach look like. He has a new book out where it's all about practical strategies that teachers are taking, kind of taking the work that he's done and applying it to the classroom. So welcome to this podcast.
Thank you so much, John. It's very good to be here.
Oh, thanks. I want to start out with just if you would share your story a little bit about how you got into this idea of brain-based approaches.
Thanks. Yeah, so it's a long story, but I'll try and shorten it for you. I'm from Ireland originally. You can tell from my accent. I've been here longer than there, yet the accent stays. That's got to do with Broca's area in the brain. I didn't know that at the time. I just thought there was something wrong with me because when my children came here, they became American immediately. I got stuck with the Irish accent. I was a teacher in Ireland, grew up in an inner city school, worked in the same school afterwards. It was all boys. And back in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't an awful lot of opportunity for children there. The parents were mostly unemployed. There was a lot of, drugs, violence, the usual stuff in inner cities. And as a young teacher, it was very difficult to survive in classrooms that had 45 to 50 kids in the classroom. I realized very quickly that if I was going to survive with these children, I would have to come up with different methods. And I hadn't been taught any of these methods, of course. The teacher training we got was basically non-existent. Mm-hmm. And so I had to invent ways to engage these children. I tripped upon a number of things that today the science says this works. There's a reason why this works. But back then it was all intuition. And mostly getting them outdoors, getting them physical, doing things that had meaning for them as opposed to for textbooks or books that they didn't even want to read. And so we had free buses in the city for children. So I would take them places. I'd take them to the supermarket. We would do work in the supermarket that had to do with reading, writing, science, math. I'd take them down to the port where boats were coming in from all over the world. And we would find out where they were coming from, what they were bringing. And some of their dads were working at the port. So it made a lot of sense for them. And then I started an outdoor pursuits club for hill walking, for orienteering, for kayaking, for sailing. And eventually we got to learn about composites and build kayaks, things like that. And so I found that when I did things that weren't what I would consider to be normal school things, the children were very excited and they actually began to learn. And since I was given, at that time, they streamed kids. In other words, they had like A, B, C, D, and E. If you were A, you were very bright. If you were E, you were dumb. That's the way it looked. Mm-hmm. And so I got all the dumb kids, of course, because I was a young teacher. And that was fantastic because I learned so much from them, how to engage them and how to learn. And that was my beginning. How I got out of Ireland had to do with suicides. There was so many suicides happening in a particular quarter in our school systems that I realized I didn't know enough. And I knew that the people who I was working with didn't know enough either, including their parents and the psychologists who seemed to be in the school only infrequently. And then looking around, I saw something that said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I thought, you know, it was a little bit naive at the time, but I thought, oh, they probably know the answer because they've got happiness. And when I got here, I realized, oh my, it's just as bad here and sometimes worse because it's way more complex here.
That's really interesting. And so in that journey, what were some things that you began to discover as you got into the research and, you know, coming to America? Like, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was very interested in education, but when I got here, the school system wasn't very interested in me. For a start, I was illegal. Secondly, I spoke with an accent. And thirdly, the subjects that I was very good at, they weren't teaching, like geomorphology, geography, and anything to do with Irish, you know, Irish stuff. They weren't interested in any of that. And I thought, wow, this is very different. And I don't think I could fit into the school system. In order to fit into the country itself, I had to start doing crosswords because I wasn't able to think like you. I couldn't understand the way you thought and why you did things that way. In retrospect, that was good because as an outsider, I got to see the system differently from people who were immersed in it. And I was lucky enough then to end up in Seattle by accident. I wasn't planning to come to Seattle. And I was on my way to Alaska because I was drawn to Alaska somehow. And I ran out of money in Seattle and I stayed there. And I got a couple of jobs teaching in different systems. And then I found the University of Washington and I went in there and I was very lucky to get involved very quickly with a man called John Bransford. He was the professor of education. And he and I talked about education and he was a phenomenal man. And I don't know, have you come across his book? It's called How People Learn.
Yes. Yeah.
And on the title of that, he talks about mind and brain. And we worked together for about 15, 17 years. And one of the last conversations we had, because he passed away a couple of years ago, one of the last conversations we had was, you know, Kieran, I spent all these years working in psychology, the black box of brain and all that. And I've done all this research and published these books, he said. But he said, the work we're doing right now with the systems of brain in the classroom, that's where the rubber meets the road, he said. And that book that was the bestseller, the How People Learn, has mentioned brain on the cover, but we have nothing about the brain inside. And he said that was a big mistake. And so what John and I began at the University of Washington was to do graduate courses on introducing neuroscience to teaching and learning for people who were interested in both neuroscience and getting into the classroom. And so from that, John had started an organization. It was called LIFE, Learning in Informal and Formal Environments. And it was a National Science Foundation program. It was the very first science of learning center. And from that, we had Stanford College of Education. Then we had the Stanford Research Institute, which is in Menlo Park, a separate research institute for doing educational research. And then beyond that, we had the iLabs, which was a neuroscience lab in the state of Washington. And then five or six different communities of learners from different schools across the country, including Boston, Texas, and places like that. And out of that, we had 10 years $50 million to study how children learn. And I was convinced that this is how we would find the answer to my question about why would a 13-year-old boy from my community commit suicide on the first day of school after the summer vacation. And it was on his birthday when his dad had bought him a beautiful blue bike, found him hanging in the closet. And that was my question. How could we solve that? And after 10 years and all of that money and all that research, there was no answer. And I was very disillusioned. And I thought, okay, maybe I was naive like everything else I had done previously about looking for the answers. Maybe there is no solution to education. And I was willing to step out and do something quite different in my life. And then the miracle happened. On the very last week when we were closing down the lab and we were moving on to, you know, John was retiring, everybody else had gone back to the silos, and I was getting a job at Microsoft. I'd already gotten an offer. It was not an education, but I was willing to step out of education because I'd come to the end, I thought. And the knock at the door was two old nurses in their 70s, and they had a small project, 5 years, $5 million with the National Institutes of Health. And they said, we can't get the sign off on this until we get a co-PI from the learning sciences. And we're looking for a learning scientist, basically. And they said, we don't even know what that is. But we were told to come to this office. And I was the last one. So I signed up, moved across campus to the School of Nursing. And I asked them, what was the project? They said, we were looking at the impact of marijuana on adolescent brain. And I had an adolescent at home, my teenage boy, and I was interested in that myself. And so I signed up and I said, okay, I will sign up if you allow me to use my pedagogic model. Now, the pedagogic model I had taken from a project at the Boeing Company I've been working with John Bransford, when we looked at moving from the 777 to the 787. In other words, engineers going from metals to composites, mm-hmm. and the learning systems involved in that. I worked with John and we came up with a pedagogic model that was pretty good. Not great, but it was pretty good. And I said, I want to practice with the pedagogic model. They didn't know what a pedagogic model was, so they signed off on that. And I spent 5 years working with the School of Nursing, and I had 150 teachers in my Greater Seattle region, where I worked with implementing the information I was getting from neuroscientists about marijuana in the classroom, and from that I learned very quickly that the neuroscientists had knowledge and information that I, as a parent and I, as a teacher, needed to understand what was happening with these children and mm-hmm. why some children were thriving in schools and some children were not. And very quickly, I realized that the information they had never left the lab because they were written in papers that nobody else could read. And not only that, they weren't interested in schools. And that's why the National Institutes of Health forced them to get a learning scientist, because their research would have been shelved otherwise. And so from that, I worked with people who knew everything about ADHD, about diet, about exercise, about sleep, about attention, you name it. They had something in their labs that had some absolute meaningful relevance for us in the classroom. And out of the 5 years, I got this incredible body of data, and I rented a huge building and I put it all on the wall, and I sat back for months and I looked at it. And that's where the solutions came from.
So it's interesting, as I hear you share this story, one of the things I'm reminded of as I think about when I was a new teacher is just my understanding as a teacher of how the brain works, right? And the way that I was taught, like the model of how the brain works, was purely mental processing, information processing. And if you think about the idea of, you know, the conceptual metaphor theory, the notion that in any given conversation, there are implied metaphors connected to language, right? As a history major, one of the things I noticed is the way that everyone talks about the mind or the brain, and you can make the distinction there, I get it, but has to do with the latest available technology, right? So the Greeks compared it to a wax tablet. Obviously, John Locke is comparing it to the tabula rasa, the printing press open, the way that when we start understanding neurons connecting, and they talk about sending signals that's coming out of the era of the telegraph.
And so the way that I was taught about the way the brain works is essentially a purely information processing model. Things go from short-term to long-term memory, and it's treating it like a computer, right? So this is the age of the computer. I'm going to college, coming out of that. And so I had this view of mental processes as purely informational and purely like a hard drive that recalls, retains. There was no notion of it being constructed, being imagined. I had them mistaken. It wasn't until I read a book on sleep that I saw the role of mental inactivity on mental processes, that when you're sleeping, all of the learning is being solidified, all that kind of stuff. I didn't even understand the affective side of how emotions were related to it. And so the question I have is, if you're dealing with teachers who have this model of the mind that they've been taught, sometimes in teacher college, sometimes culturally, that the brain is essentially just it's a hard drive, right? It's a computer. What do you think are the negative effects of that conception of the brain, and how do you address that? How do you get out of that?
Thank you for bringing this is really important. And you covered an awful lot of territory there, by the way.
All right.
We'll start with some of it. You ended up in mental models, and that's exactly the center of everything I do. It's about mental models. And we'll come back to that in a second. Remember that wall of data that I had on the wall, and I didn't understand that. I'm sitting back and I'd look at it, and then I'd go cycling or I'd go kayak, and I'd come back and I'd look at it, I'd move something over here. And after about 3 weeks of being very frustrated about trying to figure out what the hell had I come across, what was all this data telling me? Suddenly it dawned on me, oh, look at that. My teachers, the 150 teachers that I had shifted from what they were when I met them to who they are today based on only one thing. We had new vocabulary in the classroom. And so instead of looking at John as being oppositional, or Mary as being destructive, or Michael as being, disruptive, and somebody else being violent, and somebody else just having no attention, instead of having those words, we were saying, you know what, I think Mary might need to have her uncinate fasciculus tuned up a little bit. Well, who talks about uncinate fasciculus, right? What is a fasciculus? And so... To do this, we had to understand that the neuroscientists were speaking in Greek and Rome and Latin, and most of their words had no meaning for people who don't know Latin or Greek. Now, I happen to have a degree in Latin, so I was lucky enough that a fasciculus didn't scare me too much. It's basically wire. I mean, look at your computer wire.
Yeah.
Stuff that comes out of your, that's a fasciculus, right? And to think that your brain is made up of wires is a very different thing than to think your brain is just a processing computer. But even then, there's information going in, something happens inside, and something happens coming out. That was the stimulus response stuff that we got from Skinner and Watson and Thorndike and people like that. And so when I'm looking at this wall of data, I suddenly realized that my teachers had made a paradigm shift on three planes at the same time. And this was my big discovery. And when you think of three planes at the same time, you think of X, Y, and a Z axis, like an engineer would. And the X axis was mindset. And again, fixed the growth. When I found my teachers, even though they said they were growth, they were basically fixed. They knew that. And the construct to understand growth set has to do with intelligence and talent. If I know that every child's intelligence is malleable, that child can be as good as any other child, then that's good. That's growth mindset. If, on the other hand, I think, well, John is pretty dumb. He comes from a very poor family and he's the wrong color. So he's not going to be as successful as Michael or Mary, who come from a very wealthy family. In other words, I have mental models that tell me that children are either going to be very bright or delayed or something like that, cognitively not so engaged. And so that's mindset. If I can get my teachers, by using different words and understanding around constructs like talent and intelligence, now I can see them moving across that axis towards a place of growth. That's real. The second thing then, the second axis, the Y axis, was based on expertise. And we all thought, and I'm like everybody else, I thought that expertise was basically you started off as a novice. You got some exercise and practice and you got some information, and over time you became an expert. That was the plan for expertise. Well, we find out from Hitano and Inagaki in the 90s that, and he did research out of Japan, that, you know, there's an awful lot more to expertise than that. And he defined two types of expertise, routine and adaptive. And routine expertise was very like what was going on in the classroom. You walk into the class, you did this. There was a lot of routines which were designed for the classroom, but there was also routine thinking. And the routine thinking was fixed, just like fixedness of mindset. And so people who were fixed and routine were very different from people who were growth and adaptive. Do you see where I'm going? Mm-hmm. And then the third axis was the Z axis, and that had to do with motivation. And again, mm-hmm. extrinsic motivation versus intrinsic. And when you're extrinsic, you have rewards and punishment. That's all you got. And you're mm-hmm. basically Skinnerian in your thinking. But when you have intrinsic motivation, you're thinking more like Daniel Pink in Drive, who said, we've got autonomy, we've got autonomy, we've got mastery coming from that autonomy, and we've got purpose. The same way when your children are out there on the mound and they're doing things, they've got autonomy, mastery, and purpose when they find that they're doing okay and somebody swings and misses, right? That gives them the neurotransmitters that says oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, that makes me successful. And all of the cortisol that makes me unsuccessful goes away. And so you experience the cortisol as a dad watching the child on the mound.
Yeah, yeah.
Dopamine. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so when you put people into that that three-dimensional paradigm shift, you're building basically a cube. And the cube can be the size of your computer or can be the size of the universe. There is no limitation. And so I saw my teachers go from fixed, routine, and extrinsic to growth, adaptive, and intrinsic. And because of that, they were different people in the classroom. They used different words. They had different mental models. And they saw the children with potential as opposed to behavior.
It's really interesting. As you share this, one of the things I wonder about, and this is outside of, so as part of my research related to professional development, I got into the relationship of teacher self-efficacy and motivation related to how long the implementation works on a new pedagogical approach that's vastly different, right? So in professional development, you have something along the lines of, I'm going to learn a new vocabulary strategy. It's very easy to just add that to an existing model. Something like project-based learning, you're talking about something that's vastly different, right? There's fears, there's challenges, there's things like that. And one of the things that popped up for me was, and this is really intuitive, it makes sense. If efficacy is high and motivation's high, then there's a much greater chance that when project-based learning gets challenging, they continue to do it, right? Even when there's mistakes. The fascinating side of that though was, in terms of the motivation, the biggest predictor, which everybody would say is self-efficacy, was actually identified regulation. So within motivation, self-determination theory, it was those who had the highest level of identified regulation and integration. And so as I hear you talk about mindset, expertise, motivation, does the type of motivation, I mean, obviously you've got extrinsic and intrinsic, but within that sort of continuum of extrinsic and intrinsic, does the type of internal regulation make a difference at all? Does the type of intrinsic focus matter? Like I'm real curious about that piece.
Yeah. So let me just circle back 1 second. Listening to what you said, and I love the way you frame all of this in terms of how teachers have traditionally looked in classrooms, and now when they're experiencing this new dimension, which we hadn't thought about before, because everything I knew about brain was wrong. I mean, they told me stuff and it was wrong. And there was a reason for that. They didn't know back then. After the decade of the brain, everything became quite clear. And so everything changes from that point of view. When you said a while ago that a minute ago, you said that these children who engage in project and they have fun with it. And you say even, they learn even when they make mistakes. I would change the word and say especially when they make mistakes.
Yes.
And so what I'm getting at is the words are important. And so in our classrooms, we ask our teachers to never say the word but. Always say the word and. Because when a teacher says something like, Mary, you did really well today, but, and the minute they say that, if Mary is a sensitive child, and 25% of the children in any class are sensitive learners, then Mary's brain shuts down and she doesn't hear anything else except, oh, my teacher thinks I'm no good. I'm no good at math. I knew I was no good at math, and therefore I'm going to stop. And so the word but changed that child. Now, the teacher didn't want to do that and was trying to do the exact opposite, in fact. Mary, you did well today, but now we're going to do something new, right? And the minute she said the word but, Mary's brain stopped. Now, why did that happen? And that has to do with the autonomic nervous system reactivity. That's not my research, by the way. I'm very thankful to Dr. Thomas Boyce, who was up across the border in UBC back then. And he was trying to solve a very different problem. His family, I don't know if you know the story or not, but his sister had a very different life in their family to him. And he was very successful and you know, had a very happy life and did all kinds of amazing things, including being a fabulous researcher. She, on the other hand, had the exact opposite life from age 9, 10, 11, 12 on, and went downhill from there, and she eventually committed suicide. And he was trying to understand, how could this happen in our family? We had the same moms and dads, the same schools, the same playgrounds, same everything, food, you name it. And he spent 20, 30 years of his life trying to solve that for other children. And he looked at SES, he looked at all kinds of areas, and there was always too much noise in his data. He couldn't have any causative link to say that this caused that. Mm-hmm. And so one time, one night, I don't know if it was a week or a night or a day, like me looking at that date on the wall, suddenly he had this idea, oh my God, the noise isn't noise, it's the music. I'm looking at this from the wrong point of view. I'm asking the wrong questions. And so instead of looking at the backgrounds and the, you know, what's going on in the schools, maybe the teacher, maybe the sporting system, maybe the socioeconomic status, look at the autonomic nervous system reactivity. In other words, how is this child showing up in the classroom? And his definition for children, which would be the same as the definition for you or me, was very interesting. And it's not an easy definition to, so I'll go through it slowly with the words and then we'll make sense of it. So his definition was, it was differential neurobiological susceptibility to social context. Now, those words are crazy. Again, it's words, but yeah. If you think about it, differential means that you are different from me. You're unique. I'm unique. And everybody else in the classroom is unique. Then neurobiological, it's hardwired. You were born that way. So you have three children at home. One of them got maybe a short expression of the serotonin transporter gene from mom and dad. It's just a chance thing. The other child might have got a long from mom and a long from dad. So that's a long, long child. Serotonin transporter gene will decide whether you're a very happy child, very miserable child, or in between. I happen to be an in-betweener. If I had known that at age 15 instead of 51, I would have a very different life. I didn't realize that I was tending to be very sensitive around people who said something like, I don't like your accent, buddy, or you're too small, or why don't you sit over there? And I walk into a restaurant, I have to sit with my back to the wall because I don't trust anybody because I'm very sensitive about stuff. I need to see, is there a way out? Is it safe for me in here? Are they going to think I'm stupid? All that negativity follows the sensitive child. And I, being an in-betweener, I'm looking towards the sensitivity. So according to his research, and this is the genius work that changes everything I was doing, is that 20 to 25% of all children in every classroom, in any school, anywhere in the world will be sensitive with a short expression or just grew up sensitive because they were born that way. And then the part of the definition says susceptibility to social context. The social context is what causes it to be triggered. So in a playground, in the up on the mound or in the hitter's cage or whatever you read, right? That's the social context. It might be on the bus to school. It might be in the cafeteria. The thing that trigger the way you show up in the world, either you're very sensitive and you'll react or you're very resilient and it doesn't matter. It turns out that 50% of all of us on the planet are very resilient. And for that, we don't even need schools. We'll do fine, right? Schools help, but mm-hmm. they don't do great. And the problem is that most of our educators spend 60, 70, 80% of their time dealing with the children who are disruptive, you know, they're contagious in terms of causing all kinds of negative things happen. And so the other children who are easy to manage and they're compliant, they just do the least amount to get by. They don't push themselves because they're not motivated to. Why would they? The teacher's spending most of the time with them. And sensitive children, when they don't show up on a particular day or the teacher sends them off to another program, then we can get stuff done, right? That's a very wrong way to go. It turns out that Thomas Boyce's research shows that the sensitive children are the drivers of the education system. And they're amazing. When you solve the sensitive child, it lifts the entire structure in the classroom and all children thrive. Amazing to see that. I didn't believe it first because it didn't make sense to me. And then my teacher said, Dr. Omani, you got to come down and see what's happening in my school. When I solved that child that you said was, you know, solvable and I hadn't figured out how to, now I can solve it. That child is now running my class. He's dictating all of the levels of cognition, all the engagement. She's helping us all to learn better. And I'm thinking, no, look, this is data. We can't oversell this. We're not supposed to, you know, hyperbolize it. Let's just take it as it is. She says, no, you got to come and see it. So I spent a week watching and observing what was going on in the classroom. And I had to go back and rethink and look at his data again. And his data shows that the children who are sensitive, when they have supports and that we change the environment to suit them, the entire school thrives.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of punishing them or isolating them or sending them to some kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, instead of that, we support them with their cognitive systems and particularly the affective model that you just talked about. When you go in there and you say to them things like, oh, I see you got 19 out of those 20 math problems wrong. And you give them all those red marks and you say, but instead of that, you say, you got one right. I can't believe it. That's fantastic. That was the most difficult one. Tomorrow, let's get two right. And the kid said, oh, I'm good at math. I like this teacher. This teacher likes me. And as soon as my brain is able to focus on the fact that it's okay to be me in a classroom, now I can do math. It changes.
So as we narrow down and we think kind of next steps, there's a lot to think about. And I love what you've shared. So many big ideas. I'm curious for a teacher who's listening and thinks, you know, I have been treating that sensitive child as the problem, as the issue, as the main issue. What are some small, and obviously there are big changes that need to happen, but what are some small first steps that teachers can take? And it could be related to their classroom systems as we think about starting the new school year. It could relate to the way that they just are thinking about their students. But what are some good first steps for teachers?
Yeah, good. And so here's the thing. Most teachers want strategies. And the problem is, it's not necessarily strategies. It's in here. The shift happens inside here. When the teacher looks at the classroom and let me back up. The teacher's first of all in the faculty room. And she's walking down the hall or he's walking down into the gym, wherever he's going or she's going. Yeah. And she already has a mental model about what's going to happen in that classroom, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you're in the faculty room and the teacher, somebody says to you, oh, welcome, you're a new teacher, or you're starting, how's your first year going? And he's like, it's not going too well. I'm having a lot of trouble. Oh, you're in 3-7 or 3-B or someplace. You've got that child with the red hair. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. Says, oh yeah, he's, and so people are talking about this child as if he was a loser, if he was a really oppositional, angry, crazy kid. And the point is, when we as educators walk into a classroom, we see complete and full potential. And this is why every brain has 100 billion neurons and every neuron has 10,000 connections. So if you do the math, you've got trillions and trillions and trillions of potential. And so why would you think that child has more potential than that child? They don't. It's the same as any other child. However, their lived experience and the fact that they're hypersensitive and hypervigilant have caused them to be in a place where they're already shut down, and they're not able to process information the same way as the child who's very resilient and who can handle all kinds of ACEs, we'll say high ACEs, or some kinds of stressors. Or the fact that I walk into my class and I'm wearing my white shirt today instead of my black shirt, and the teacher or the child says, "Oh no, he's wearing his white shirt. He probably hates me." As opposed to the other child who says, "He's wearing a white shirt." It doesn't matter. Do you see what I'm saying? The hypersensitive child is always looking for the, am I going to be safe? So as a teacher, I first of all have a mental model that says, no matter what anybody says in the faculty room, I'm walking into my class knowing that all my children have potential. Every single child, even the child who is nonverbal, even the child who's in a wheelchair and who hasn't moved for years. See what I'm saying? No matter how neurodiverse they are, every child is neurodiverse because it's all wiring and we're all unique. And so I'm way diverse than you. And you should be, because we're not the same people. We couldn't be. My fingerprints and yours are different as well. And so the point is, I'm walking in there and I'm going to say, if I can change the environment of this classroom so that every child can thrive, that would be very difficult because there's 25 kids here. However, I'm very lucky because I can see the sensitive child. Everybody knows them. Already they're the ones who are at the principal's office. They're in detention, in school, out of school detention. These are the children that I focus on. When I solve the most difficult child in my classroom, I solve my classroom. When I solve a classroom, I can solve the school. It's happened many, many times where one teacher solves the most difficult child in the school and every other teacher says, "How did you get John to give you writing samples? How did you get John to engage and want to do more science?" And you say, "Because he's got potential like everybody." And I don't let him get into amygdala hijack. And the teachers say, "What did you say? Amygdala hijack? What is that?" And so when I change my vocabulary, I change my mental models. And by changing my mental models, I'm now able to approach education from the way it should be approached, through brain, not through behavior.
So if a teacher is interested in this, what would be a great first book? I know you've written several different books. What would be the book that you would say, start here?
Yeah.
And move on.
Yeah. So what happened was, I didn't plan to write books, by the way. I was too busy working. In fact, I was at the university. And do we have time for this? Is it okay to tell this short story?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I was at the university and one of the professors said to me, "Look, so-and-so is sick. Can you take over and do that class down at the convention center in Seattle?" And I'm saying, "What class is it?" He said, there's a conference and we need someone to do 20 minutes talk on brain. I said, "Sure." I said, "What's the conference about?" He said, "I don't know. Look it up yourself." And so I planned to go down and do 20 minutes on how the brain works, right? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't thinking about, you know, education or anything like that. I didn't even know what it was about. And I looked it up before I left and it was NCCE. And I thought, what the hell is that? And it turns out it was a IT conference for computer science. And I'm like, holy shit, I know nothing about computers. I mean, I do, but I don't know enough to be able to stand in front of, you know, a bunch of people. And I thought, there probably won't be very many people wanting to talk to a neuroscientist about IT. So there'll be no one there. And so I go down, find parking, and I go up on the escalator and I can't get off the escalator. There's so many people lined up to get into the room I'm going into. And I think I must be in the wrong room. You know, there can't be that many people. So I asked the fellow in front of me, he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm going to that neuroscience talk about, you know, the brain." And I said, "Why?" I said, "Isn't this an IT conference?" "Oh yeah," he said, "but we're all IT teachers. We've given these iPads and computers to these kids, and now our lives are destroyed because they're pulling off the delete keys, they're losing them in McDonald's, they're throwing them at each other, and we're just repairing computers all day, and it's not what we signed up for." And I said, "Why is that happening?" He said, "Well, they thought that would solve discipline, but it made it worse." And so as I was going into the room, and there was room for 25 people, and there was about 150 people trying to get in, and there was a man at the door stopping them, and there was a big crisis over that because they wanted to hear what was going on. So I changed my talk, and I began to talk about how to engage children in classrooms as opposed to what I was going to talk, which is about the brain. This is what the brain is. And all those people squeezed in, and they're sitting on the floor on the windowsills, and it was just incredible. And after that, one of the teachers came up to me and said, "If what you say is true, then I should be able to myelinate a new structure for and name the child." We'll call the child Billy. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, how old is the child? She said, he's 10 years old. 10 years old, he's so malleable. You can, of course, you can myelinate new structures. And she said, but I don't know what that means, but I'll get back to you. And so about 3 weeks later, I get a phone call at home. And this lady says, what would happen if I built a social narrative? And I said, who are you? What are we talking about? And she says, remember Billy? I'm going, Billy who? And so we're back now to the NCCE. And she says, I'm myelinating a new structure for him. And I'm thinking if I use a social narrative. And I said, I have no idea what a social narrative is. Mm-hmm. Are you telling him stories? And she said, I'll get back to you. So about 3 weeks later, I get a phone call again. She says, you have to come to our school. And I'm saying, who are you again? I mean, I have no idea who these people are, right? And so I get dragged down to way down about 100 miles south of the school, out of the university. And I go there and I'm expecting to meet this teacher. But in fact, when I get there, it's the car park is full and there's like five or six schools of teachers in there. Psychs, you've got speds, you've got people who are administrators, superintendents, principals, senior, you know what I'm saying? All these people. And the question was, what did you do? And I'm like, I didn't do anything. I wasn't even here. This is my first time. I'm saying, where's this teacher that called me? And she said, I'm here. I said, what's this about? She said, well, we want to know how you solved Billy. I said, what happened? I mean, I was afraid he's been dead. Did you kill him? And what happened? And she said, well, I myelinated a new structure for him. I said, how did you do that? She said, I did what you told me. I said, what did you do? She said, I built a social narrative. What's a social narrative? And so this is the genius of educators. When they know what they're doing, they can do amazing things when they get liberated out of that old box of behavior. Mm-hmm. And so what she had done was she took an 8.5 by 11 and she drew a line in the middle and she had six boxes up on top and six boxes underneath. And Billy and her drew pictures, stick figures of the six things that triggered him and the six things that he loved to do. And mm-hmm. she said to him, and he colored them in, and he said, the first thing that really triggered him was transitions. When the teacher said, okay, we're moving from, you know, reading to math. And he wasn't finished reading. Mm-hmm. And he was just blown up. And he was throwing desks and shooting and killing. And it was just a nightmare. Yeah. And this class was shut down. And so she said, Billy, when you feel yourself getting triggered by that, just pick one of these here. Like if you want to feed the fish or water the plants, whatever you like to do, go to the library. I'll let you do that. He says, you will? Of course I will, Billy. And so immediately Billy's behavior changed. And 3 weeks later, he's like the best kid in school. It turns out that Billy, like every child, has a plan. Mm-hmm. And when the teacher made visible what the plan was, Billy mm-hmm. then felt part of and a sense of belonging in the classroom. His plan was he wanted to go to the cafeteria every day and have lunch with his friends. The problem was he had no friends because he was too violent. And the other problem was they wouldn't let him into the cafeteria because he ended up, you know, throwing food and throwing kids and throwing chairs and everything. And so he never got to the cafeteria and he had no friends. And as soon as he calmed down and he got to do the things he would like to do instead of screaming and fighting, and suddenly he was writing and he was reading and he was doing academic stuff. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we solved Billy, all these people said, we have Billys in our schools. We want to know what you did. And so the idea, and by the way, she had spelled myelinate wrong on the whiteboard. And I was thinking, man, this is amazing. She can't spell, but she's doing amazing stuff with the child, right? And the reason you can't spell myelinate is because it's such new vocabulary. You know, we don't want fasciculi and hippocampus and cerebellum. And do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And supramarginal gyrus. You don't want that in your classroom, but you need it in your classroom. And if you're talking supramarginal gyrus, you're into metaphor. If you can get children into the supramarginal gyrus, now you've got children engaging and bringing all those lobes together so that you've got wiring that has them be in the limbic system, the PFC. And suddenly these children are able to say things like, oh, I realize that when you say it's raining cats and dogs, there are no cats and dogs. It's just more water. And you say, yes, we've arrived at the supramarginal gyrus, right? Uh-huh. That's where Einstein lived, by the way. He saw images of numbers in spatial colors, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Just so many big ideas.
And by the way, I forgot to say, this is...
Yes, and so the Brain-Based Classroom would be a great first one for folks to pick up. That was the book that you would say is like a great first start, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course...
And then you have the...
for the teachers.
The neural.
The teachers.
Guide. Yes.
And if I could say one of my teachers, just one example, a teacher who was, again, struggling with all kinds of issues in the school with children who were disruptive and all that. And she took one class and immediately changed her mental models and began to work in the school for the BIE, which is the Bureau of Indian Education. And as you know, if you look at the data, those children tend to end up at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of academic achievement, but also graduating in school. During COVID, she took her school from 48% graduation to 100%. It's never been in the history of American education, 100% graduation during COVID. And so she's bettered across the country. She was taken to Washington, D.C. and given all kinds of accolades based on understanding new vocabulary, new mental models, and then implementing that in our school.
Oh, very cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and your insights. And everybody, go check out his books. These are great works. And I'm really excited to take a dive into, especially that first one that you described, because I've got so many things going through my mind right now. And I'm really excited.
Thank you so much, John. It's really fun to be here.
Thanks.
So there we have it. That was Kiran Omani, and I really enjoyed this podcast interview. Please go check out his books if you've not checked them out yet. If you're not familiar, it is a fascinating set of research that really gets to the heart of what we do in designing our classroom culture and doing classroom management and the approaches that we take when we do things like project-based learning. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you get your podcasts? Also, tell a friend about it. Word of mouth is one of the best ways to find out about a podcast. So again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.